This is Anne Taylor on behalf of the Milton Historical Society in an interview with Ralph Hayward, a veteran of World War II. This is an interview with Ralph Hayward, a veteran of World War II, taken on behalf of the Milton Historical Society on June the 14th, 2005. Ralph, can you tell me a little of how old were you when you joined up, what made you join up, where you served, just a little bit of history before we go on to your wartime experiences?
Yes, I was 18 and joined up in the 1942-43 and was a conscript when I didn't volunteer. I was called up because it was that time.
This was in England?
In England, yeah. Mm-hmm. And my father was a butcher in Nottingham, England, and I worked for him, of course, until joining up.
All right. Where were you assigned? Could you choose the discipline, like the Navy, the Air Force, the military? Could you choose, or were you just assigned somewhere?
No, I could choose, and I chose the Marines.
Oh, you did?
The Royal Marines, yes.
Okay. What type of training did you have?
I was called up from Nottingham, where I lived, to Devon, and we did 8 weeks military training, square bashing and that sort of thing. Then we did a further 8 weeks field training, ammunition, firing, all that type of thing. And then I volunteered for commandos and joined commandos.
You did join the commandos?
Oh yes, and I went from the...
That's a very elite group, is it not?
Oh yes.
So you have to pass a high standard?
A very high standard. Good.
What type of exams did you have to pass to?
Well, mainly fitness. Mm-hmm. The marches, day march, a normal small march, speed march would be 20 miles. If you did a long march, it could be anything, 30, 40 miles.
In a day?
Oh, yes. And you may have a small speed bubble chucked in as well. Speed march, that's supposed to be a bubble. Speed march chucked in as well.
Now, when you were conscripted, was there a rate of pay in those days, or were you just bed and board?
No, we didn't get pay. Oh yes, we got about a shilling a day.
A shilling a day, mm. In 1942-43, what
right.
Does that equate to now?
Well, oh gosh.
So much.
Well, it's only about 20 cents.
20 cents a day?
Yes.
Okay. How did your family feel when you were conscripted?
Well, they obviously were all very upset. I had a very good mother and father. And
were you an only child?
Oh, no. I had two brothers and a sister.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had a good family.
Did you?
Yes.
Did you belong to any religious group at all?
Other than Church of England, no. I've always been brought up Church of England.
Did your faith have any bearing on how you dealt with the war? Was it a comfort, or was it just simply something you had grown up with?
I can give you the same answers. I was in action in Normandy, and I was in a very awkward position, and they couldn't get to me for several days. And the Padre sneaked to get to me. I had the commander of Padre, you see. And he asked me what I thought of religion. I thought, it's a wonderful thing. I think it teaches children the standard to live. And I still believe that same thing. I think religion is a good thing.
Okay. But it helps you?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So after training, where did you go? In other words, what was the history, your history during the war?
Well, first off, I went to pass the commando course. Mm-hmm. It was in Scotland, mm-hmm. on the Highlands of Scotland, with a place called Achnacarry Hall, which is near Speenbridge, Fort William, Scotland. And it's there's been a great monument put up to what we did in the war, what the commandos did in Fort William, and Kate and I go there every year. Every year on the Armistice Day, for the armistice parade, for 25-30 years after the war. I would be there, and it's 400 miles from Nottingham. You know, it was a 420-mile drive each way, and the roads in England aren't like they are here, you know. And when you get into Scotland, I mean, they're very windy roads. To do where you would think of doing 100 miles, you would be doing probably 35-40 miles in Scotland.
It's a good time too, aren't they?
Oh, a lot of it,
yeah. Yeah.
When you get up north, you see, it's quite lovely if you've never been. Well, you know Scotland, man.
Oh, yes, I'm from England.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, you know, where I'm from Nottingham. We're both from Nottingham.
Oh, okay. But you met here?
No.
You've known each other for many
years?
Yes,
for many years. And a family. I've known the Wolver family.
Really?
For many. Oh, yes.
And when did you get together?
It's what, 10 years?
11 years ago now, yeah.
How did you get together?
Well, we both lost our partners. I was over visiting my mother. But I'd always corresponded with his mother and father and Ralph.
They used to work for him.
Because I used to work with his father years ago.
In the butcher's shop?
Yes, that's right.
Wonderful. Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
So after after that, where did you go after your commando training?
Well, the commando training in Scotland, I was sent to join 46 Royal Marine Commando in Folkestone. It's really no lattice, so,
yeah. Yes.
So it was at that time of day. It was 24 hours on the train from Scotland, and of course when we got on the train it had been chucking it down with rain, absolutely saturated from the other train. So we got to sit there, because there were no compartments, you know. It was just in one little thing like the bad days. You hadn't got the where you could something you could walk through and go to the toilet or anything like that. Not in the old trains. And of course we had to come all the way down from Scotland. Quite an experience.
When were you shipped overseas?
We were stationed on the south coast, training to do raids on France or anywhere. The main things we were engaged in was blowing the cross-channel guns. We were to go and raid those or knock them out, knowing that this was all the build-up towards when the invasion of Europe took place.
When you say raid, how did you do that? Over the water?
Oh yes. Yes.
In a hidden boat?
Amphibious landing craft, yes.
Yes. Did you dive as well? In wetsuits?
Oh no. Mm-hmm. No. We were just like infantry in landing craft, for instance. That we were in. We got a Belgian cross-channel steamer that they'd taken the lifeboats off the side and put davits on so that they could lift landing craft. We've got three landing craft on either side, and that was the ship we were, a ship called Prince Albert, that we used all the time, even right till Normandy, until we went into Normandy, that it was on all the time.
Were you ever frightened?
Oh, many times about ever.
How did you cope with that?
Well, not well, really. When some things are just terrifying. You hear the machine guns firing. Our machine gun fired about 300,000 minutes. German machine guns would fire 600,000 a minute. And when, of course, you're in close combat, as we were, I mean, the first impression of we, as I was very close to her, a machine gun took my friend's head off right up in front of me.
Oh.
His head went past me in a hail of machine gun bullets. I still feel it now. Really ask how it affected you now.
Do you still have nightmares?
Oh, yes.
Still?
Oh, yes.
After 60 years?
Oh, yes.
I can vouch for that.
And could you ever talk about these things for a while, or did you just keep it inside you?
I find it better to talk sometimes. I mean, it really upsets me now, as you can see it is doing, to talk to you. But I find it better, and yet Kate will tell you that I'll probably be kicking and fighting all night now.
Really? Because it's bringing back. Well, it's very kind of you to go through this.
No problem.
It's for posterity. You know, people don't understand.
I've got to explain to you that my wife was educated in Timmins, and her mother died in Canada in 1939, and she brought her home to England, to just yards away from where I lived, and that's where I met my young lady in 1939.
How long were you married?
43 years. She passed away.
How did you cope with the separation? You were married before you?
No, we were not before I joined up. No,
you're 18, yes.
That's right. So no. But when we came the first time back from Normandy, after we'd been into Normandy and come back, we knew that we'd be sent out again very quickly, expecting to be shipped to the Far East. We were. And then while we were in England, the Ardennes push happened in Belgium. They broke through American lines, and we were rushed back to France again, you see, then to Belgium and France. And on up to Germany, across the Maas, the Rhine, where he said, they are where they are. I'm not telling you, Will, am I? But
you know, you're
on the first leave back in England.
Yes.
Oh, I did get married on a 48-hour pass.
Oh, you did?
From the Isle of Wight, you see.
And what year was that?
What? 44. And that was in December in 44.
So how old were you then? 19. You were 19 when you got married?
Yes. But it was. Well, we didn't think I was going to live very long.
No. Must have been hard for your wife.
Oh, yeah. It was hard for everybody, yes, it was.
How many times did you manage to get back during the period?
Only once more again after that. But that next time was back from, by the time we'd done France, Belgium, Holland, and Germany. And then we came back again. Again, raced back to England quickly as soon as the Europe was won, we was flown, get back to England to be flown out to the Far East to get to Campbell Hardy, where he was already out in the Far East, our commanding officer, who have told you.
So where in the Far East did you go?
Didn't. We came back to England, and whilst we're here, they dropped the atomic bomb, and that's it. You see, we didn't get to the Far East at all. But I think we were lucky we didn't. We've done enough to do it.
Yes. Yeah. What was the most critical period when lives were at risk that you were involved with?
Oh, the most critical period was the job we did for the Canadians in the Village Row that you've seen the photographs of. That was the most critical time because the Germans were very strong. Their tanks were very, very... that was... behind Kate's head you'll see a small tank. That was the German Tiger tank, and that is the one that got the 88mm gun, and it really and truthfully, without being anything wrong to the English tank men or the Canadian,
they couldn't.
That would knock out 6 or 8 of our tanks before they could not be there.
And what is it called?
The German Tiger.
I'm sitting here looking at a number of photographs that you've kindly lent me to reproduce. Could you explain for the record what they are?
Well, this first photograph here is one that was taken in Normandy on D+3. That was 3 days after the landing.
This is a photograph in a town with a lorry and soldiers in front, and you are by the right wheel of the lorry.
That's right, yes.
Okay, what were you doing there?
We had just been in action against the Tiger tanks. we'd radioed for the war spy to shell the area, and that was where we were moving on to now, moving on further again down the road.
And the one when you went to team?
That's the action.
That
was blown up for me, yes.
Okay.
The paper, my own local paper did that.
Okay. And the one with you in recent dress?
That's right.
Was that taken?
That's in Row. That's in Row. And that is he was a sergeant major in my commando. And that's where we've been lifelong friends. That's Joe Rowis. Mm-hmm.
On the occasion of what, the anniversary?
Oh yes, yes.
Oh, 60 years. Yes. Okay. And these documents that you have lent me, what is the significance of those?
Well, this is the letter from the Canadian General thanking us for what we did for the Canadians on June D+5. That was in the village called Row, where the Germans SS had been stationed for some while and been very hard on all the local community. And the Chardiers tried to take it, and of course they'd never met the.
And the Chardiers
SS.
Are who?
The Chardiers were French Canadians.
French Canadians, okay.
And the Canadians granted us some support from the I'm forgetting the name of it. Fort Garry Horse.
Yes.
Fort Garry Horse supplied tanks to give us the support to fire and cover and fire as we went in to here, and we went to do a raid actually. As a reprisal raid for the Canadians, what the Germans had done the day before, in the actual action, they'd killed about 30 or 34 Germans, the Chardiers, but they'd taken some prisoners. Then they'd slaughtered them all, the German SS had.
They shot them together?
Oh yes, they did. And when the first, I'm going to jump again for you, because I was going into the village. I was just in a position, just inside a little wood, and I was with Jack Davis, a pal of mine, and we were just cutting the wire. It was no great defence, only farm wire really, not because the Germans, they weren't expecting us the way we'd gone in. No. We'd gone after them the back door, to be honest. And we were in this little wood, and we were just cutting the wire to get out of it. And there was two fellows, I could see in Canadian uniform, run right up to us, and right against the other side of this wire, they couldn't see us because of the bush line, the edging, got down and said, of course, immediately I took them prisoner, I got my tongue, and I was right at their heads. They had no chance.
But they were Canadians.
Oh no.
Oh, they weren't.
They were SS men in Canadian uniform.
How did you know the difference?
I didn't only the German machine gun.
Ah, that was smart, heavens.
That was the only thing. But still, I'd got to be sure. I wasn't going to blow them away, and to find out I'd killed Canadians, not likely. So
but
then I
just
course.
The gun that tipped you off.
Oh yes.
So I wonder how many other, how successful they were with other people who weren't so astute.
That's right. Well, you didn't know. I was very lucky. I was very, very lucky because they'd not see me there. Not see me at all.
Yes.
And I was so lucky. And then I got them. But then, when I told the one to turn round, he actually shit himself. But I'm sorry, it's true. But he was of course, because he knew he'd be shot.
And you shot them?
No, I didn't. No, I knew they were vital information for the Canadians. I sent them both alive back to Canadian HQ, where then they were.
This may be a very touchy subject, but have you ever executed anyone?
No, not as an execution, no.
Just in self-defense?
Oh, yes.
Ralph, in this modern photograph, you have 6 medals.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what they were for?
Mainly Normandy, that's right. It's the 1939 45 star, the France and Germany. You see, we're for all the fighting we did, like between Normandy and Hamburg. We got nothing for that. We've got one here from the Dutch. So that's one of the bad ones. But that's not one that you displayed in your main display, the main display there.
Now, is this for actions or is it just for being there? Because I think every soldier got...
That's it, for
one,
being there.
Yeah, I see.
That's right.
Okay. Have you had any narrow escapes other than the one you just told me about? Many, by the look.
Things that stick in your mind. Taking another position against the Jerry SS. After this, so some weeks after this, 9 plus 10 weeks after this, at a place called the Zule, the Germans had occupied the main road from Caen. By this time we'd taken Caen, on the main road between Caen and Paris, they'd occupied this high ground at the back of the Zule, and we hadn't got access to get on towards Paris strictly. This has got to be taken. The paratroops went and tried to take it in the afternoon, and they let them move up three fields up the side of the hill, and they let them get in. RSS did again, same with the Paris, and they'd done with the Chardiers. They let them get right up to it. Then the last field, they just mowed it down. They got guns, machine guns on two sides, and the Paris had no chance.
It was a slaughter.
So of course Campbell Hardy went and had a look and said, well, we'll take it. But we're doing a night job.
A night job.
So we went to do it that night. We got 3 fields to go up, and you remember you've got the barbed wire and the fencing and all the local things, probably not great harm as the Germans would have done it themselves. But obstacles that had got to be overcome to get there quietly. And we sneaked our way right up, cutting the barbed wire, and there was a lot of Paris still squealing in agony. Oh. They'd never moved and they were still there tonight. I'm fortunately, it's not my turn. We all took turns to lead the commander. And this night was my turn. The first man.
And how old were
right
you?
Still 18. We're going up like that, up this bank. And I'm the front man, and it's all pitch black. Always we keep saying, leave us, we'll be quiet. We'll get you some help as we can. We've got to give us some quiet. Give us a chance. We'll get help to you quick. Plus, I'm about, far from here to that tree. From this big, it's the cage at the top where we knew the Jerrys were digging.
That's about 50 feet.
Yeah. And the machine gun bursts right from the right, with traceable. It's a black, pitch black, you got it. Smash me, tummy gun out of my hand. Yeah. And I'm standing there. No use going back, I've got to go there. I dive straight forward and fall into a trench with 2 Germans.
What happened?
Well, I was delayed a bit, but I killed them both.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
What did you use?
My hands.
In your commando training?
Yes, and I got a grenade in my fist, and I was worth it. When I hit them, they did know they'd been bloody hit. But, that's right, I'll tell you that one.
Well, this is what
you have to do just crazy things. You mean at that time, you're in a frenzy then. You're fighting for your life. You know you're fighting for your life. It's up to you. And of course it was up to me.
And they were probably roughly the same age as you.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is the sort of thing you have nightmares about.
Oh yeah, and of course then to get through the thick age and go forth, and we took the place.
You did?
Oh God, yeah.
How many did you lose in your...
I can't remember that night.
A lot, though?
Well, you know, there'd be...
Too many?
Yeah, probably 30 or 40 men killed.
You were never a prisoner of war, were you?
No, thank God.
Did you ever visit any of the war camps before or after the war?
I went to, relieved at Belsen, if you like.
You relieved Belsen?
Oh, yes.
You liberated Belsen?
We liberated Belsen. We were there actually before the SAS. No, the SAS are very good, like we worked alongside the SAS.
Who are the SAS?
Special Air Section.
Okay.
That's the move. Elite, you see, right?
You were in there first?
We got there first. We got to Belsen before them.
Can you describe for posterity exactly what you saw?
Oh, God. It wouldn't be...
This is another nightmare situation.
We were not allowed to go into the camp. We were warned that there was this camp. They didn't know what it was, for sure. We knew all we could tell, don't go in the camp, there's trouble. You might get disease or something like that. Go, you're not allowed to go in. So we just got there. And we'd probably been there five or six hours, and then the SAS came, and that's really the storm of the Germans that came here to fight. You've seen photographs of the other Auschwitz and those places. It was exactly the same there. There's piles and piles of bodies. That this was near the River Elbe in Germany, and they used to put the bodies in what am I calling?
Trenches?
No, in a boat. A barge, that's what I was thinking. Put the bodies in barge and take them out into the ocean and scuttle the barge. That's what they did. The extra for bodies. Oh yes, so that's something probably you've never heard of, but you've heard it now. It's true.
Did the bodies not come up because...
No, they scuttled the boat.
Oh, I see. They weren't on top. They were in the boat.
They were in, yeah.
And that's not generally known.
Well, it was well generally. It is known.
It's not known.
A secret. You're not the first to know, Mother.
Yeah.
But it's a thing that's not talked about a lot.
Yes, yes. But you did go into the camp eventually?
Oh, yeah. I'm a butcher by trade. I was slaughtering anything I could find. Any cattle, big sheep, any black thing, to help to feed them and get them something to eat. And
because they had nothing when they were liberated.
Oh, no. We'd no backing really. I mean, no backing at all to help them. All I could do was to give them meat. That was the best thing I could do for them.
Were there any aircraft dropped food parcels?
No, at that time.
Not at that time? We had nothing?
No.
How were you received by the prisoners, or were they too weak?
Too weak, but so terrified. They didn't, if a German walked past, oh God. They're terrified. Really. It's difficult to explain to you that they've just been so prisoners so long that they were truly in another world. You couldn't, just all you could do is sympathize and help them, you know. I mean, I killed him some pigs one day. Big pigs, you know. You know when you kill a pig, you have to dehair it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were some big coppers, so I got some. Got some of my mates, and we got fires going, got the water cooking, so we could boil them, so we could clean these pigs up, like, you know, do like a proper job of them. And we were doing this. But we'd done it for, 2 or 3 days, frankly. And then one day, of course, we're called out, we've got a bit of something to go sort out. So, because we're still in the front line, you realise this, although there's not a lot of imposition by that time. There wasn't a lot of opposition against us. But we had jobs we had to see to. And we had to go and see to. And when I came back, they got this blasted boiling water going. You got a pig in it, just picking it up, hands full out with hair and everything all over it.
Just to eat it. How many people were liberated? Do you have any idea?
No, several hundred. I can't tell you. I can't tell you.
All with no food?
Oh God, yeah, well when we got nothing, truthfully they didn't know, really, then. Well, they knew there was something, some sort of a camp there, but I don't think the information was good about it.
How long was it before the backup could get food?
Oh, any days. Probably a week, 10 days, that's all.
Enough for people to die, though.
Oh, yes, but there were some help got to us. But, you know, yes, there were some giving them something. But nothing really could, was there specially for them. The dynamo, no.
The prisoners of war in these camps, well, how would you assess, how could they readjust to life after an experience like that? First of all, their health would be broken, I would
think. That's right. A lot of them were only political prisoners, you realise that. Not prisoners of war. They were also, it was like a concentration camp, you realise that.
What was the difference between political prisoners and prisoners of war?
Oh, well, prisoners of war had the
soldiers.
Yes, they had more rights than the political prisoners. They literally had no protection at all.
And they were all in together.
Yes. No. Not with military. Oh, no. They were separate. There was a separate regime that altogether to handle them.
What happened to the guards that were there when, were they just shot, executed, or were they taken prisoner?
Some were taken prisoner, obviously. Mm-hmm. I won't tell you about that, but, you see so many things. I mean, we did another little camp just down the road before we got to Belsen, and it was only on a small sort of river, and like a canal one side and river the other side, small island in the middle, and there'd probably be 500 or 600 people in there, and children, but a lot of them women and children, and they heard that we were getting near, and they tried to escape. Well, it was one of the worst things I've seen in my life.
They were just mowed down.
They were in the water, machine guns in the water. And there was one.
You saw it?
You see it. One thing I'll never forget, all along the stair, Leo, there was one girl with a baby, with a shawl around her, got a baby in the leg. And she must have been a fair swimmer, the youngest lady, like, you know. And she swam this little river. Swam it and got across, and she's just clawing up going over the bank, and machine guns across here, so. And,
were you ever wounded?
Yes, only slightly, nothing very serious.
But where was the...
I was blown up at the Falaise Gap. That was just as we were breaking out of Normandy. They tried to gap, which they did. The Americans and the British and the Canadians sort of closed the gap, and we were going into that. We were moving right up, and a shell dropped to the side of me. Not badly.
No.
I was, when I came to, I was in the field dressing centre, and my eyes were bleeding, my ears. And,
concussion, was it?
Yeah, but from, yes, right. Concussion. And it hurt my back as well as I landed. But only hurt, not broke anything, nothing, bones broke or anything like that. It just stringed my ears out and cleaned my eyes up, and had a look at me, and of course I knew my mates would only be fighting for their lives then, because in the last little bit every man was needed then, so I just had this done and I went straight back to Munich. No other treatment at all.
So were you in pain?
Well, my back was bothering me a bit, but not a lot.
Other than your friend who was decapitated next to you,
yeah.
You saw a lot of your friends killed or wounded?
Oh, a lot of tremendous wounded. I mean, with mines, where they were very bad for taking limbs, you see. Men lose the leg. All of them. With somebody losing something every day, you know.
Did you ever, you did visit the field hospital when you were injured?
Yes.
Do you ever watch MASH on...
A little bit, yes.
How true is that?
Typical American, I've never seen the American one. Sorry, I don't know what to say about that.
It's too romanticized, it's much worse.
Well, it's never got so much talk about doing nothing, haven't they? Well, that's true.
I guess the doctors in those units were called up too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. How many countries did you visit in the war?
France, Germany, Belgium, France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, that's it.
Were you ever in touch with any of the resistance in those countries?
Oh, yes.
They helped you get in? And
I was always very impressed with the help of the Dutch people once we were in Holland. The same as you will find if you talk to your Canadian friends who were in Holland. They were the best. I saw the Mackey shaved ladies' heads and that sort of thing. It was supposed to have been fraternizing with the Germans, you know, and all that sort of thing. But I can tell you this, of all the Mackey, that give us no good solid help like the Dutch did. They were the people. The Dutch resistance, to me, was the best of all.
How about the French resistance?
A lot of shout and a lot of nothing.
Nothing.
But we were many times, you see, we were through German lines. We were in, often, like, that's happened on a regular basis. You'd find a Mackie man and get some information.
A Mackie man?
Mackie, that's a French Mackie. That was a French underground.
How do you spell that?
M-A-Q-U-N-D-I-S. Mackie.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And the Dutch underground, what were they called?
I can't tell you.
All right.
I can't tell you.
Were you ever in contact with the German resistance?
Never. No. Never saw anything like that.
Okay. Before we get to your homecoming, can you just talk about anything you want to talk about that affected you or you were involved with in the war? An extenuation of, continuation of what you've been talking about?
I've not spoken about my friends. So many of my friends in my unit, in my troop, there was roughly 60 men, or 24 I think. That was mainly through mines and shells and that sort of thing. The most terrifying thing, I think, was that when you were fighting in woods and you were being shelled, the shells hit the branches and the trees high above your head and explode. And the shrapnel and the ripping into the ground at the side of you. No way you could move around, no matter where you went.
That was deliberate, they aimed at the trees?
Of course. I could tell you one place over the River Aller in Germany, we were actually surrounded for 3 days. We should have gone, you see, we're being clever. We're going to do an assault landing across this little river. When we get to the river, there's half the bridge not broken. Not, they tried to blow it. We couldn't drive a vehicle across it. We could walk across on some of the planks, you know. So we go across. Protect the bloody place. Then we get over there. Of course then, we can get no follow-up, no help. No tanks or anything we follow. Because they can't get over, they can't get a bailey bridge or anything ready. So, for 3 days like we're surrounded. And of course it's all wooded in the German area. We're in this particular area. And the shelling, it really got us pinned down for quite some time. So much so that we had to do a bailing charge to get out. I've got more papers to show you.
You've got more papers?
Yes, sure.
Okay. Can you tell me, Ralph, a little more about the commandos, how they started, and anything you can tell us for the record?
Oh yes, so Churchill wanted to form a group of men who would be able to move quickly and go into action anywhere at very short notice, and that would got to be either from land, sea, air, anyway. I had I did my parachute jumps in 43 at Manchester Airport in England, a place at that time called Bringway. But once you'd earned your Green Beret, you had the honour of being able to go anywhere at any time. The police, the military police could obviously stop us and check us, could stop and check where we were going and make sure we were on valid things, but they could not hold us. They had to, they had a phone number they could ring and check where they would be told whether they could keep us or whether I was on something that I'd just got to keep going. And if they got, they told them, they told them that I'd got to go on, they could not hold me. And that was an honour of wearing the Green Beret. I mean, to me it was a big thing. I see people over here, we don't really know about the Green Beret. To me, it was a great honour. And of course, in the summer of 1940, when Britain's fortunes of World War II...
Can I just stop you?
Yeah.
You're reading something there. Can you tell me what it is?
It's The Commandos, 1940 to 1945. And it was written by Churchill. In the summer of 1940, when the fortunes of World War II were at their lowest ebb and an enemy invasion was seen... threatened Winston Churchill, boldly ordered the raising of an elite force to raid the enemy-held coastline of Europe and to regain the initiative. The new units, which initially consisted of volunteers from regiments, corps, British Army, were called the Commandos. Within weeks, they were in action in Europe, in the Middle East, and the Far East. During the next 5 years, they fought in every theatre of war with such success that the word commando became feared by the enemy, yet respected by friendly forces. In 1942, the Commando Basic Training Centre was established in Scotland Highlands at Achnacarry. The potential commando soldiers who then came not only from the British Army, but also the Royal Marines and the Allied Armies, underwent the tough and purposeful training. Only those who successfully completed the course were accepted and privileged to wear the famous Green Beret. The distinctive headdress was acknowledged as the hallmark of the highest standards of military training: self-discipline, physical endurance, initiative, bravery, courage, whilst under the simple motto, "United we conquer." Comradeship beyond the literary discipline was born and fostered and flourished. For their valour in the action, the commandos earned 38 battle honours. Many awards included 8 Victoria Crosses, where many were made the supreme sacrifice. No fewer than 1,700 commandos lost their lives, and others were seriously wounded. It was recorded that prompted Winston Churchill to pay the following tribute to the commandos: "We feel sure that nothing of which we have knowledge or record has ever been done by mortal men which surpasses their feats of arms. Truly, we may say of them, when shall their glory fade?" This plaque was unveiled at the occasion of the Freedom of Lock Harbour conferred on the Commando Association on the 15th of November 1993.
Oh, that's very touching, isn't it? You must be very proud.
Very.
Yes.
Yes.
How many of the commandos you served with do you still keep in touch with?
Oh, I think there's about 20 of my commandos still left alive. Yes, we do have a reunion every year.
Do you?
But of course, now I'm in Canada, I'm afraid I don't get. It's usually in October in England, and I don't get to that.
Well,
I've tried very hard to go to the armistice memorial at Spionbridge, Scotland, as many times as I could. I think we've been, Kate and I from Canada have been over 5 or 6 times in the years we've been there. But we do try hard to go there. It is the major one for me because they put up the monument to us for commandos 1939 to 1945. A great monument, and we're very highly honoured of that. Very.
It was a huge job to give to such relatively young men. You've just handed me a postcard that says the Commando Memorial, Speen Bridge near Fort William, the Highlands of Scotland. This is the memorial that you went to see last year?
Oh yes.
And this is where you go every year?
Oh yes. Well, we try to every year, yes.
Every year?
Oh. Yeah. Every Armistice Day, because I just look at that and I think of my friends that are there.
Yes. Yes.
It's the only one place that I get that feeling.
And that's there?
Yeah.
That's there. Did you, you attended the celebrations in Milton?
Yes.
How did you find that? Was that a good turnout?
Oh, very good. Very, very good. Very good. We did us proud.
We did.
Yes.
Can we just
touch? Laurie McNabb looks after Reimagined Rail.
Ah, Laurie. Now, I think Laurie is the person in the Milton Historical Society, is she?
Because we went. Oh, yeah, we did. We did, yes.
She is behind this. Behind this program.
Is she?
Oh, is she?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yes,
she is. And we're meeting tonight, so I will hand this over tonight.
Yeah.
Just before we go on to after the war, can you just tell us any other reminiscences, anything you think that history should know, like the real unvarnished truth, that it'll be painful, but people, you know, the younger generations don't know what people went through in the war?
Well, it's rather difficult to say that because, you know, the real times of the action when it really hurts most is when it's obviously one of your very great friends. Particularly with my, in my case, I've explained when I was at Roe and took the two German prisoners. Ballot side of me was a fellow called Jack Davis. We'd been with the commando for quite some time and we'd been in every action together. We'd gone all the way up from Normandy through France, Belgium, across the Rhine, we're up into Germany. And Jack was killed. And my other friend who'd joined with me, they were both shot in the back of the head.
Were you there?
Yes. Yes.
That would be your worst moment in the war?
Oh, yes, because oh, I can't describe it. They were just two wonderful friends, wonderful, my best friends, and I always swore I'd go to the grave. And I tell you the truth, I was 53 years before I'd go to Germany, because I just didn't like the Germans. I wouldn't go to Germany to see, but at any rate, after 53 years, I'd promised myself I would before I die. Go to their grave. And I was very, very pleased to find that they were both lying side by side.
Was that coincidence or was that a request?
I think it would have been a request.
And where are they buried?
In Germany.
In Germany.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there mass graves? I went to Arnhem.
Yes.
And that grave site was terribly overpowering.
Oh yes, it is.
acre and upon acre of crosses.
Oh God, yes.
Just
yes.
Awful.
Yes. Bad job. Yes.
What other reminiscences can you record?
Well, you've got to think that there are many good times, many of the good times you did have, and your friends, that has to be a, you couldn't live if you didn't have some good memories and good friends. And yes, that I would like to say is a key thing of all, and what keeps you going is you must remember the good times, although the bad things cannot be wiped from your memory at all.
Mm-hmm. When you were on leave, did you find that most of the people parted heavily in order to try and forget?
Oh gosh, yes. Oh, not hard. Oh, I mean, when I first joined up, I'd had two glasses of beer in my life. That's all. But I'm sure you, once you'd had this type of experience that we've had, I mean, at that time we got no treatment for trauma, no matter how bad your nerves were shaking. You didn't get, got no treatment. All our local doctor was Dr. Kiddy, his name was, the commando doctor. Always said, go and get bloody drunk and get it out of your system. And of course, that's so many of us did. We became alcoholics, roughly. Yes.
No, I was just going to ask you, yes. Are a lot of them people you know still, do they have a drinking problem because of this?
Well, we all like a good drink. If that's a problem, I'm sorry.
What about the trauma?
No treatment at all.
No treatment, no.
No. I now get a pension for it. But
For what?
Trauma.
For trauma?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you do to qualify for a pension for trauma?
Well,
serving in action?
Oh, yes, it was serving in action. I got it, yeah. Well, in my particular case, I mean, I can't speak of everyone. I mean, there are various things that... in action, you've got something different every day. You've got a human, one day it might be mines, one day it might be shelling, the other day it's in the close quarter fighting with machine guns and that sort of thing. It's a different thing. It's a accumulation of things in action, but any other experience that would warrant trauma, I can't tell you. Although it must have been terrible for men flying and that sort of thing, which was different altogether to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And of course sailors in the Atlantic shipping, I mean, that must have been a terrible job.
Mm-hmm.
On their nerves, what a pressure on them, good God.
What was your leadership like in the war? Of course,
wonderful.
The commandos is a little different. They're the elite force. But
that's right. Oh, yes, it was beautiful. We had very, very good officers. Wonderful. Obviously, some were better than others. The Barry Pierce that I've just been talking about, one of my friends, he finished up a captain. We joined the commando together. He was just a sub-lieutenant, and we'd been friends all the time. He was the bravest man I ever knew in my life. He'd just go there, I'd sit in front of the Germans, and be sitting there timing what they're doing. Oh, unbelievable.
So he wouldn't direct you from behind, he would be up there.
Oh God, yes. Oh, all the commando officers were.
Up front.
Oh yeah, they never very rarely wore pips or anything like that, so they'd go picked off.
Oh. That's right. Anything else that you can tell us about the procedures, for instance, that sort of thing?
Oh no, well, I mean, you've got so much respect for the men that they were doing it with you, that it was a wonderful thing that you'd got to comradeship together, you see. Didn't matter whether the man was an officer or an ordinary rank or whatever he was. You were all there to do a job, and that was how you were treated. And that's why I like the commandos.
Were there many commandos or military people that you know of that were sent home because of trauma, that they just could not
shell-shocked? Some were, yes.
Yeah, but they had to be extreme cases?
Yes.
I see.
Yes, very extreme cases. Something did happen with them, you know, and they couldn't help it, like they were sent away, that was it. Returned to units, but it was not an honour for them. They didn't get away it wasn't an honourable thing to happen, but it was just quietly done and there was end of it.
Did they get a pension when they got home?
Oh yes, most of them. I don't know whether they've got them. I mean, I can't honestly tell you. I've seen one of them that was sent out. I've never met one of them since, because they didn't really like to, wouldn't we want to be coming to be reunions when that had happened.
That's right, yeah. Any other general feelings on what happened, day-to-day life?
Well, it was quite, you know, we lived on what they called compo rations. You got a box with tea, tins of corned beef and sugar and tea. Oh, you ration for 24 men in a box like that, you see. And that's why in France and Germany, well, that was why I was a lucky fella, because I was a butcher. I used to kill cattle, and we'd go out on patrol in no man's land. We'd have steaks in a pocket to be eaten. And so it was, it had its good sides as well. But thank goodness it did, because you've got to be something to.
You've got to relieve the pressure somehow.
We were up at Belsen, and I tell you, I was killing any bloody thing I could find for these people to get them, chickens and anything. And I remember one night I found some, but not many, about 30 or 40 chickens, you know. Well, they just killed a lot of them, no problem, and got them for them, and so they got these people something to eat. And I didn't find out until after the war, and I was at one reunion, and one of the artillery blokes who'd been following us behind happened to be there, you know, and he said, yeah, you were pretty well, so I said, yes, I was. He said, I saw you. I said, you said you went one place and you killed some poultry, didn't you? I said, I did. He said, we brought them up from Normandy with us. We were getting eggs in the top of them.
Oh!
I said, why didn't you stop me? He said, I thought you'd have bloody shot me, did I? That was his reply.
Ralph, what type of souvenirs did the people bring back?
Oh, good ones. Well, I brought a lot of swastikas. I brought...
What type of swastikas?
The ones, the big flags, but mainly the ones that had outside the main buildings in cities, you know, with monstrous things. Big, you mean, oh, 10 or 12 yards long. They weren't little things, like, you know.
How did you bring them back?
Well, we got them back, don't worry about it. I'm telling you everything. We came back, and it was our lucky word in the commando. He said, we came back, and we'd all got some things we shouldn't have, bring back, you know. Oh yes, loot, we called it. And we'd all got something. The general comes aboard, thanks us all for what we'd done, and gave us a warning, like we'd going through the customs, you know. So some of our houses were chucking stuff overboard, you know.
What sort of stuff?
Not all the loot they'd got from Germany and everywhere, you know. And, well, some pistols, all sorts of things, and, you know, but good things that they got from Germany. And, of course, they're chucking them overboard, and it took mine overboard. And then when we got to come off the ship, the general had arranged a big marching band for us to march us off. So they marched us straight through the bloody customs. We all got through. So that was one advantage of being in the commando. Marched us straight through, and we all got a loot arm, so.
And you still have that sort of thing, do you?
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to give that to your grandson?
Yes. I've got a not very good pair of binoculars, haven't I? Zeiss binoculars that I got brought back, yeah. He's got a swastika and that on. So. Oh, yes, I've still got it. No, there we go. When I came back, my father had got the butcher shop in Bulwell, Nottingham, and he, at the side of the shop, there was a great waste ground. And so, when the VE day came, there was I was home for celebrations of that. So we built a great bonfire, and then I got these big swastika flags that hang out and outside the buildings. We draped them across the... what on earth did they be worth now? I honestly don't know.
Oh, you burned them?
Yes, we bloody did.
Oh.
So all three of them draped right across and burned those buildings everywhere. So
they would be worth quite a bit.
Oh, they would be, yes, now. But no, they would burn.
What other celebrations did you see? There were street parties.
Oh, really? Yeah, it's a good street party. Wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You were there, weren't you?
I guess so.
You blooming should do.
Yeah.
Because you worked for my father at the time, you see.
And that's where you're at. Let's go on to that for a moment. When you came back, did you have a hard time adjusting?
Yes.
In what respect?
Well, life has been so different. You know, I can't really explain to you how much different, because each man with us had got to do a job, and if he did his job, that was fine. You got respect for what you did. And when he came back into civilian life, it wasn't the same story at all.
Did you find that people who hadn't gone to war seemed very superficial?
Oh, yes. Very.
Yes. Right. And did you find that went all through your life?
Very much so. Very much so. And you find it even now here in Canada. Yes.
Can you enlarge on that?
Well, yes. People who've never been in the army and that sort of thing.
Or being in a war-torn country?
They don't understand what it is at all.
No
understand. And don't care. They have no care at all. I don't.
Yes.
I think a lot of the people who have come from Europe have been in the bombing and that sort of thing, and so they have some feeling for it. But a lot of people just have no and can't imagine what it was like.
Can you tell us a little about the rations during the war?
Oh, yes.
For the army and for the people?
Well, when we were in action, I could soon get something to eat for us. We'd never any problem without being short of stuff to eat, but in England it was a bit different, you know. We all had to have a bit of something off black market somehow, but it was a very tight and a very hard job, the rationing in England. You got perhaps one egg a week or something like that, and very little butter and little flats and anything. You even got clothes coupons to get clothes. I mean, life was not good. People have no idea what it was like to live under those circumstances. What do you want to say, Kate?
Well, like, for instance,
yes.
I mean, I fruit.
Yeah.
We had the Christmas time. Apples that were actually sent from Canada. So the children just went wild for an apple. As I say, during the war, you just didn't see very much fruit. A banana, some children never saw a banana until they were probably 5 and 6 years of age.
How did it affect your father being a butcher? Was he told what he could do with his meat?
Oh, yes.
What
My
were
goodness
his
inst- me.
What were his instructions as a butcher?
It all came from the ministry. They came from the ministry offices. There had to be one in every town that would be ensuring that these rules and regulations were carried out. Ministry inspectors would be round the blasted shops. You really got problems.
Well, how did they determine rationing for the butchers, for instance?
Well, I mean, the butcher got a certain weight of meat that he'd got to allocate to so many people. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And he'd got to cut it out, whether it be stewing meat or steaks, it'd all be classed as meat. Didn't matter what sort of meat that was that they got, but that was what they got the customers could have, that's all. And it was it was a blooming hard job, I'll tell you.
Was there a lot of black marketing going on?
Oh, yes.
In what form? How did it operate? Without being too specific.
Well, it happened that everyone... Some people have got a friend on a farm, and they get perhaps a few eggs extra, something like that. And it would start like that, and somebody, you might swap some eggs for a bit of meat or something like that. A lot of bartering. But the thing was that it started something moving, and then sort of one thing grew from one thing to another until we learned how to go out at night and perhaps kill something and bring it home and butcher it.
Poach it.
Oh yes, that's right, that's right.
Well, it's survival, isn't it?
There was survival, isn't it?
Yes. I guess you went straight back to work with your father.
Oh, yes.
The average person who didn't have a father with a shop, did they have a hard time getting a job?
Not really. If they'd been in the army, and especially if they'd been abroad with the army, they'd usually be, their work would be guaranteed that they'd have to go back to the same firm that they'd been called up from.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Only I've heard stories of people in the war coming back and all the jobs were filled. So that, well, that is, I've heard those stories.
Right, but I mean, that wasn't the normal.
Okay, their jobs were protected.
Yes, with knowledge of the large firms.
Yes.
You must understand, for a small concern, that it'd be very difficult for them to lose a one man. The whole firm's going to close.
That's right.
Oh. So, I mean, very difficult to hold it open for them.
But did you find it hard to settle down again to civilian life?
Oh, God, yes.
How long did it take you, do you think?
Years. Years, yeah.
What form did it take? You just couldn't... You were just... what's the word? You couldn't settle, or...?
You couldn't concentrate.
Really?
Yes. It was the worst thing. You couldn't concentrate on anything long because your mind had been, well,
Do you find that you gravitated towards people with the same experiences in
yes.
your social life?
Oh yes.
Because they understood?
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
So you joined the Legion where you were?
Of course.
So that was that's where you...
Oh yes.
Which is social.
That's right. That's right. We still do. We still do.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Ralph? Anything at all that you think the future generation should know? Kathleen, can you prompt Ralph here?
I think that one thing I would say to the youngsters, all youngsters, they're as well going into some kind of union, some kind of thing that helps them together. I think, like you can say, the Legion or any sort of club, there's the Lions Club and all that sort of thing. They're all
yes.
good. And they're all good to help. And they do help you in your private life and they help you in your life by trying, as I say, from your religion, teaching you a decent standard and everything. And all these things help, I believe.
How did you view religion when you came out of the war, having seen all of the terrible things that you saw? Did it affect your outlook at all?
Never. Mine has never changed. Never. Not at all, because, as I told you, when the Padre came to me, and I told him, I thought it taught certain standards for you to live by, and I believe that, and I still believe that now today.
Was there any, I guess not with the commandos, but in the forces in general, was there any discrimination?
Not in my unit, not at all. No, 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 no. There was no discrimination of class, breed, anything. No, none.
And the commandos at that period was all men, was it not?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's
not so today, though, is it?
I believe so. I believe so still, yes.
Okay.
I do keep in touch with the Commando Association, and I'm a founder member of the forming of the Commando Veterans Association, which we formed last year at Nakari on Armistice Day.
The Commando Veterans being veterans of the war or commandos?
We include all commandos.
All commandos.
We're going to this veterans will include all commandos, not just wartime ones, because our wartime one finishes September this year. That'll be our last of the Commando Association of the 1939-45 commandos, which I'm a member of, as you know. That finishes this year altogether, because they've given all the money they've got away, and they've been very good to everybody. And it was run by commandos and did commando things, and they've done very, very well to look after us also.
So the commandos were started in the war by Winston Churchill
for a
special purpose, and have continued on as a separate unit ever since.
Yes.
It's quite a history.
Quite a history, yes. Really love to say how honoured I thought I was to be able to do something for the Canadians, as we did on June 11th, 1944, for which the Canadians did and were very grateful to us and sent a wonderful letter thanking us for what we did.
And that's the letter that we've discussed.
Yes, the letter that you've discussed. But I can tell you this, something I've not told you. We came over to help the Canadians once when they really wanted it. That was on June the 11th. We fought alongside many times after. But just after doing the job of June the 11th for the Canadians, the Americans were several times in trouble. And my unit was moved onto the American sector on a minimum of 4 occasions to assist the Americans, and never once a letter of thanks or a commendation or anything. We rode in there with our heaviest weapon, which was only be a 2-inch mortar. The Yanks have got tanks and artillery and everything, that much firepower, and they couldn't bloody hold anything. We went and did the job for them 4 times.
No thank you.
And never said a thank you to us at all. Now I've never seen any letter from them in any way.
And that's a very sore spot for you.
Well, it was, because, I mean, God, we're all there fighting for our lives. I mean, life was so cheap.
Yes.
Thank you, it don't cost anything. And besides, it was only right. I mean, the Canadians did it. We didn't have to ask the Canadians for thanks. They gave it us.
Can you tell me now, just on a personal note, you and Kathleen have been together for 11 years.
Yes.
What is the history behind the two of you meeting again?
Well, we always had been a bit of spark between us, I'll tell you that. I mean, that's quite true. No use telling lies. I mean, when Kate came over from Canada, she usually came to see my wife and I. So we've been friends all along.
And she, first of all, worked for your father in the butcher shop.
That's right, yeah.
At the age of?
14.
And you kept in touch?
Yes, when Kate came to Canada, you see, every time she came, she would call and see us. We'd usually go out for a meal or something, wouldn't we?
See his mum and dad.
That's right, yeah.
And then when your spouses died, you decided to just get together. And you're quite happy living in Canada?
Oh, I love Canada very much.
You do. You obviously love the Canadians.
Some of them.
Okay. Well, Ralph, it's been a pleasure talking to you on behalf of the Milton Historical Society. Thank you very much for sharing your experiences, and all the best in the future.
Thank you very much, and the best wishes to everybody in Milton.